Hi, Kelvin.
Hi, Ade.
Kelvin, we are doing these wonderful talks about tetrionics. And we've just been doing some talks about mathematical problems, which are very well known. You explained the P versus NP problem. And we talked about the Navier-Stokes problem. And essentially, it turns out that in tetrionics, those problems don't exist because tetrionics uses completely different approach. It starts with the Planck unity and then from there on builds up and shows how energy fields form matter. And you said that today it would be a very nice moment to talk more about this relationship between mass and matter, and that they're actually very different, that they're actually not at all in the same dimension. Which also means that they should not be confused in physics and in mathematics. So I'd like to ask you to give your take on that.
Sure. Oh, look, we covered a lot in the last couple discussions, mm-hmm. as you said, on various mathematical approaches to physics and where the mathematics comes unstuck. Obviously, from the tetrionic perspective, tetrionics is at its essence just a different analytical geometry to explain physics. From its earliest inception, mathematics, geometry, just geometry is the pattern. It's the shape, the topology, the shape of the fields, things like that. Whereas the mathematics is about looking at patterns that emerge when we measure these particles in motion, measure the physics of our universe, and from those patterns that we see, we can formalize them in a mathematical language that again allows us to repeat the experiments and predict the outcomes of experiments, and that's the modern scientific method. It all stems back from, obviously, Descartes, where when, from his philosophical musings, he developed the need to express what he'd observed and what he could formulate mathematically into a more robust science, if you like, the science of physics and expanding mathematics along the way. He ran into problems, obviously, with the church at the time, because the church at the time was the power, the giver of knowledge to the world from the Bible. They had discussions with him about what he was trying to do in seeking these books to be published about these mechanics of the universe, telling God how the universe worked, rather than just being in awe of the fact that the universe did work according to his divine will. So there was lots of discussions, and in the end they came to an agreement, and the basic agreement, the detente if you like, was that Descartes could publish his musings and his philosophies on geometry, coordinate systems, mathematical treatises, observations of physical bodies in motion, things like that, but he was forbidden to look at or explain the immaterial parts of the universe, the things like fields and the human spirit, the Holy Ghost, all these sorts of things, because that was considered to be the realm of the church's authority. So with that little toehold or a wedge, we managed to get science started. Well, he managed to get science started as we do it now. Newton came along and contributed, and many, many others have come along and contributed to the process. But it's always tended to be a case of measure of observing material bodies in motion, or being created or destroyed, and the effect that creates. We've observed physical processes. We've then looked for patterns that we could formulate into mathematics to describe these processes in order to speculate on what's causing it at the quantum level. And it's been a top-down approach, observation, formulation, extrapolation. And where we've come unstuck, in my belief, is purely because the focus has been on looking at material things. For example, a lot of times you'll see many, many works on magnetic fields of bar magnets and things like that, which by saying the magnetic fields or permanent magnets completely negates and wipes away the fact that there's an associated electric field with the magnetic, because science has been looking for things that we can observe and measure, the properties that announce themselves, the physical characteristics that we can say, well, there they are, we can measure them with a device, or we can see them with our senses, and we develop our math on that. It comes unstuck because by doing that, we're completely not observing and not considering the immaterial fields and what they're made of and their contribution to physical forces and fields of interaction, things like that. We need to bring them back into the fold. And as I developed Tetrionics, what I quickly discovered was that as well as material and immaterial fields, we have other areas of physics that physics either poorly defines or struggles with completely because of the mathematics. And they're things like mass versus matter, quantum geometry versus quantum topology, what is charge, what's the source of charge, what creates the two types of charge that we have, and what's the role of electric charge or electromagnetic charge at the quantum level, so far as its role with how it makes or contributes to the universe as a whole. A lot of these things became readily apparent in Tetrionics, because Tetrionics starts with this singular entity of energy. It's a Planck quanta. It's an equilateral geometry, but it has no time component, just like Newton's equations and Coulomb's equation. It's not time dependent. It is just an equilateral geometry of energy. That's the founding block. It's got two sides, a positive and a negative, and it's made up of electromagnetic fields. It's what a lot of people would term a zero-point field. It's half a photon. It can be either the positive half or the negative half of a photon. And the symmetric geometry of this field and the arrangements of the electric and magnetic dipole gives rise to all the material and all the immaterial forces, the material particles, and the immaterial forces that we observe and describe in physics that up until now have just been mathematical abstractions. Now, where it gets really powerful is because we start with this quanta of energy, the entire universe, if Tetrionics is to be taken to its extreme degree, is built up of nothing more but an innumerable number of these triangles, so that it's just like a computer game. Everything we can see, whether it's material or immaterial, is made up of these triangles, which is probably one of the biggest steps in comprehending how this entire theory works. The Planck quanta of energy, once you place it in a measurement of time, dE, dt, simply becomes mass. It's energy per c squared, energy per second, which is a measurement of mass. And again, that goes back to Einstein's mass energy equivalence, E equals mc squared. So from a tetrionic perspective, if you want to talk energy, you have no time component in the equation involved in a measurement of energy. But the moment you add a time component, make it relativistic or take a time sampling or a number of samplings, you differentiate it over time to see the change, you're immediately referring to mass more so than energy. Energy still remains there, but it's more appropriate to call it mass, which when I developed tetrionics then brought the immediate question of, if that's mass, how do we define matter in this? How do we define the material particles, the atoms, the compounds, the planets, the stars, the galaxies, etc.? What is it that makes them different and yet made out of these same Planck quanta, these little triangles of energy? And science had the answer, but it was never rigidly geometricized, if you like. It was never put into a geometry that clearly showed what it was. And the simplest form of this is where four triangles of mass energy and their associated momenta interact in such a way through their electric and magnetic field geometries to create a tetrahedral of mass energy. And that's what I call a tetrion. This tetrahedral topology is distinct from a mass energy geometry in the fact that it has volume. It has a Z component. It has height. It has width, depth, and therefore, as the fact that it's a closed volume, it has a displacement topology. The displacement topology is important for matter because that's what gives rise to gravity at the quantum level. Or it's one contributing part of universal gravitation. So we now have a definition that we have energy and we have two other forms that immediately arise. We have mass once we start taking time measurements, and we also have matter. But more importantly, we can differentiate between all three. If there's no time component in the measurement, it's a measurement of energy. If we have a per second time measurement, it is mass, a planar sheet, if you like, of energy. Per second is mass. It's an equilateral geometry. So therefore, you'll often see me writing about mass energy geometries. And when I do that, I immediately picture these flat sheets of paper, triangular shapes. And however you can arrange those flat triangular shapes, they'll make different fields, electromagnetic fields. And I resist the temptation to follow the standard course and call photons particles for that reason, because a particle is a topology, it's a matter particle. So therefore, under this definition, if you're going to call something a particle as opposed to a field, it must have a positive displacement topology. You get that because the charges interact in mass energy and they form these tetrahedra. The tetrahedra have charged sides to them, whereas fields have a positive and negative either side. When the tetrahedra form, the external field or charge is what we measure, but we can't measure the internal or the inverse side of the charged fascia, so that becomes suppressed. So you might have four Planck quanta, which have positive and negative either side, but when they form a tetrion, four equilateral triangles forming a tetrahedra, you'll end up with either a positive tetrion with four positive faces that you can measure, because the negatives will be internal and can't be detected, or you'll have a neutral made up of pluses and minuses, or a negative, which is all negative externalized and the positives internalized. What I'm trying to stress here is the sheer event of turning a geometry into a topology has an impact on what we measure mathematically and physically at the macro scale. So even though I can describe that a particle will have a certain charge, it still has a balance of charges, but some of that's suppressed. You can't explain that purely with mathematics, because the mathematics just sees it as a positive particle or a negative particle, but it has no explanation for, or any idea even, that these opposite charges exist inside it. So now that from a geometric perspective, we've got a definition of mass, energy, and matter, the next thing to realize is that once matter is formed, all forms of matter have inherent mass energy, and any force applied to a material particle will create a secondary chem field, a kinetic EM field, which is pointed or arranged in the direction, or sorry, its linear momentum and electric field are arranged in the vector direction of motion for that particle. These fields are fields of mass energy. So if a force is applied to a material particle, something with a positive displacement topology, the energy of that force is stored in a secondary chem field geometry. Now, as soon as I've said field geometry, you should realize that that's mass energy. There is no matter component to the secondary field, to the chem field. And equally, the mass energy momenta in the chem field is not part of the matter topology. They're distinct geometric components to a physical system. The chem field extends out in the vector direction, as I said, from the particle. You can have various chem fields. You can have a kinetic EM field, a chem field, which is in the direction of motion. And you can have electrostatic fields where two chem fields act in opposition and form an electromagnetic field around a particle, or an electrostatic field. It could also be described as a magnetic field, because illustration 408 gives the various arrangements of these fields at the quantum level as energy is stored. Now, it could be thermal energy, it could be energy of motion. They're equivalent in so much as that they're both comprised, both field types, or three, are comprised of Planck quanta. So we've now got a stage where we have the building blocks of the universe being Planck quanta. They are energy quanta, but once we introduce time measurements to differentiate things and different forms of energy, as energy just combines with these triangles, we can then differentiate energy into mass, energy, and matter. Once we have matter, any material body or particle will either have an electrostatic field of charge around it, or it will have a magnetic field around it, or in a final example, it can have a force applied to it or act upon it to produce a secondary vector chem field with energy momenta in it. This extended chem field is an answer to one of Feynman's big questions in his university talks. Richard Feynman goes on to bring up an interesting point, and that is we know that electrons, for example, don't have supercomputers inside them, yet they know where other electrons are, and in fact all other particles around them are, and they know the charge of those particles, and they act instantaneously to those particles even though they're separated by huge distances. Now obviously they're not doing the mathematical calculations that physics would do in order to determine their path and their deflection and their velocity changes due to applied forces and fields of interaction. But somewhere there has to be a mechanism at work that allows a simple subatomic particle to know and act and react to particles around them, respective of their of the other particles' charges. How this happens in QED theory at the moment is by the exchange of virtual particles. Again, this highlights physics' legacy of dealing with particles to explain exchanges of energy momenta, when in fact we have bosons, which comprise fields of mass, energy, momenta. They're field geometries. Every chem field has quantum level bosons that make up the energies and the momenta of the field to give us our squared energy levels. As all matter particles radiate these fields, whether they're positively charged or electrostatic, magnetic, or particles in motion, they all have these fields radiating out from them in their direction of motion, or in bilaterally in the case of static particles. These fields of mass, energy, momenta reach out and they propagate at the speed of light once they're developed. They reach out and spread out in various directions, just like the typical drawings of a positive and negative charge. They go out in all directions from the particle. I'll see if I can find an illustration that shows that. It'll be 4.09. Gives us a clear... once I can get it to the right box, which it's not going to do. 4.09 is the illustration that shows us best. Typically, in mathematics at present, you'll have a point particle representing either a proton or electron or something similar. It'll have a positive or negative charge that radiates out equally equipotential from the particle in all directions. The same thing happens in tetrionics, except where you see spokes radiating out in classical or modern physics from the particle, tetrionics shows that those spokes are actually a top-down view of these equilateral fields. If you were able to turn these spoked models of point particles 90 degrees, you would see the fields that are illustrated at the top of that illustration for charged EM field geometries. We've got three fields there. We've got positive and negative electrostatic fields, two fields of each type, and you've got a neutral electrostatic field, which would normally end up being, because of the neutral electrostatic part, would be a magnetic field, is how we would detect it in the macro scale. Irrespective of whether it's electrostatic or magnetic fields, you have these diamond-shaped fields of mass energy, or these diamond-shaped geometries, that radiate out. Now, typically, as in that illustration there, you'll see that positive is normally drawn as a vector pointing away from a positive particle, and a negative charge particle has vectors pointing inwards But you'll see in my illustration in both cases, the positive for the positive field points outward, and the negative for the negative field or negative charge particle points outwards. But you'll also notice that there exists the opposite charge pointing inwards. So in the case of a positive charge, we have a convergent negative energy momenta. So this is the beginning of the explanation of Coulomb's law of attraction. Whereas current textbooks show positive and negative fields as sinks and sources, and that's it, with energy only going unidirectionally into or out of those charged fields, Tetrionics reveals that the actual explanation for the mechanics is that they are interactive fields. And by that I mean they have divergent and convergent energy momenta in these equilateral field geometries. The upside of that is, as drawn there, a positive electrostatic or a positive point particle has positive fields radiating out and negative energy momenta converging on it. So it will attract a negative particle towards it, but it will repel positive. Whereas the negative, as illustrated there, has negative diverging from it and positive vectors converging to it. So again, the negative will repel negative charges, but it will attract positives. This is the basis of how electrostatic fields of force attract and repel. And it applies to magnets just the same as it does to E fields that we've drawn here. This is how Coulomb's law works. It's not a single repulsive or attractive, it's a bidirectional force, and it's known to be a bidirectional force at all times, but it's not drawn or mathematically formulated as such. 4.11 in Tetrionics then shows the electric and magnetic force vectors for these fields around material bodies. So from these fields that are of mass energy around matter, we now have a mechanism of storing energy, of force applied, and storing thermal energies as a field. And all these fields contain equilateral Planck quanta. So again, we're still building from the basic building block of energy, but now we're in this picture, we're showing the mass energy momenta fields. And it's these fields of interaction that create motion, that cause particles to move towards or repel away from other particles in their vicinity. And when we move particles, when we create external magnetic fields, they in turn have these force vectors that will cause charged particles to move within them. So in Tetrionics, you'll see Coulomb's law of attraction constantly referred to as simply being the law of interaction, to highlight that there is always bidirectional forces. And this distinction of bidirectional forces and how the quanta make these fields becomes extremely important in understanding universal gravitation as yet another force in physics. But again, whether it's Coulomb's law or Newton's law of gravity, both with similar formulations, they're made up of equilateral mass energies. It's the mass energies as a EM field that stores the energy of force, that creates fields of interaction and makes particle material objects move. They're completely unseen, even though they're color-coded here. Just like the particles themselves, there is no colouring in these fields. They are the ghostly part of physics that's so poorly understood at present. Now, we can delve a bit deeper into Coulomb's law, in particular, in 4.12. And this is where we see how Coulomb's law, which is force equals K Q1 Q2 over R squared, it's an inverse squared force, just like gravity. We can see how it actually works. We have a number of particles there, and you can see the arrangement of equilateral Planck quanta making up the EM fields, or the, in this case, the electrostatic fields around the particles. Now, right in the center of that illustration, you'll see two fields overlapping, two electrostatic fields. Where they overlap, you'll see that we have, in this case, electric permittivity squared, but it's just a form of energy squared. And the square associated square root linear momentum of those two fields creates a force between the two particles. That force is proportional to the charge and the mass energy of the material particle that creates each field. If you had a particle with twice the charge, in the illustration there, they're both the same charge, but if one had twice the charge, there would be a resultant doubling of the attraction in one direction or the other towards the particle with twice the charge. If you change the charges, you change it from being an attraction to a repulsion. But at all times, it's a two-vector force, so a bidirectional force, and it's created by mass energy. Mass energy is giving us these interactions. The material particles themselves, the store mass energy, but it has no, it's simply a way of making the particle solid and giving it a positive displacement topology. It has no real effect on the motion of the particle per se, and it's certainly not affected by contractions due to velocity. And we'll touch on that again just shortly as we go a bit further into this. But now we've got a good grounding of the difference between material particles, topologies, and immaterial mass energy geometries in physics. So the immaterial ones, the ones that we don't see and we haven't normally dealt with, are ones that are normally described in physics as fields of bosons or photons, odds or evens in tetrionics. Odd pi geometries are bosons. They form quantum levels of energy, and they're the exchange particles. They transfer charge, because they're an odd number, charge, energy, momentum from one spot to another. They're the basis of all electromagnetic induction, whereas photons have two pi geometries, and they form EM fields, which are even numbers, because 2 + 2 = 4 + 2 = 6, onwards and upwards. So if you see a even number, it's a photon. Sorry, a 2 pi, it's a photon. A even number of Planck quanta will give you a EM field. So we have odds and evens, 1 and 2, as a basic mathematical concept expressed in a geometry. And those numbers apply to mass energies and immaterial field geometries. So the geometries are giving us our force. They carry electric and magnetic components. They have linear momentum. They, if they propagate as a photon or as an EM wave, they have kinetic energies. And in turn, they can create chem fields in electrons or other particles. So the thing that we haven't been studying through Descartes' initial arrangement in setting up physics was the basic numbering of mathematics in physics, if you like, the geometric building blocks. Can you imagine building a mathematical description of something and being forbidden to use one or two, or evens and odds in your formulation, or know what those numbers particularly represented? That's what we find ourselves in now, hence why QED has to use virtual particles to exert a force between particles. It has to borrow the energy, create a particle, exert the force, then turn the particle back into nothing in order to have a field of interaction between particles. From a geometric perspective, that's patently absurd. But that's how QED works at present. Tetrionic QED has a completely different take, as we've just started to hint on in this discussion. To quickly touch on Newton's laws, 14.01 is not a bad illustration. It simply shows that under Newton's second law, F equals ma, if you apply a force to any object, any material object, matter, the chem field, which stores the energy of that force, will create an associated linear momentum or a velocity for that particle in proportion to the mass of the material topology that's being accelerated. Now, as this illustration shows, the energy momentum of the force is simply equilateral Planck quanta in a chem field. It's a equilateral, open quotes, squared, close quotes, energy field. And the energy levels, to go from one squared number to another, as per Fermi's difference of two squares, will always be an odd number. So you can even see other great mathematical formulas creeping back into basic physics of immaterial fields of force. So in this example, on the top left, you can see that if you take away an odd number from the squared energy of the field, you will have a smaller number of quanta in the field, so it decelerates. You can look at, say that as an odd number can be expressed as 2n minus 1. So as the n level, which is the pink linear momentum, the vector velocity, changes by minus 1, we lose a boson, an odd number of Planck quanta, and therefore there's less energy momentum to have that particle moving at a higher speed, so it slows down. Equivalently, you can add energy. In the middle case, we have 13 as the base odd number of quanta for the quantum level. If we were to add another 15 Planck quanta, or a boson of 15, we would, of course, have more energy momenta in that field, and the field would be an acceleration field. It would increase in velocity. So now we've got not only interaction between particles because of their fields, but the exchange of odd number bosons of energy allows us to facilitate electromagnetic induction of energy momenta at the quantum level, and to accelerate the particles, not just influence their direction, we can actually speed them up or slow them down, depending on the charge of the field and the energy momenta, quanta, in those fields. So in all this, we're actually talking about mass energy, immaterial fields. You can't see them. You can't see them, but you can certainly feel them. You can feel the force that they create, and it's a vector force. It's the square root of the scalar energies. Newton, in formulating his laws, worked on changes in linear momentum or changes of velocity. So he was looking at the pink square root, the height of the triangles. Leibniz was working with E equals mv squared, so he would have been talking about the entire triangle of energy and its effect. Different aspects of the same thing. So where there's a great debate between the two men, we can resolve it by simply showing the complete geometry and saying Newton focused on the height, whereas E equals mv squared focuses on the scalar energies involved. So now we've got motion between particles and particles being able to accelerate other particles. So when we come to, I'll give you 14.07, so when it comes to an electron, for example, we can now show the matter topology of the electron, the 12 pi charged fascia that it expresses, which we know is the elementary charge. It's not minus one. It is in fact minus 12, because there are 12 charged fascia. It is a 12 pi topology, or what people would call a dodecahedral platonic solid. It is a physical material matter particle, whereas the field of motion or its electrostatic field, either one, both, are in fact mass energies. They're just equilateral sheets of energy that radiate out from the particle. Now, this applies to all particles. If we had a proton there instead of an electron, we would have an icosahedral topology, which would have a 36 pi charged geometry. There's 36 charged fascia that make up the three quarks that make the baryon. But once the three quarks combine, the 36 charged geometries make a 20 pi charged topology. And this is where tetrionics steps head and shoulders above all other physical theories, because we can actually show the hidden internal structure of all subatomic particles. It's not just the topology we can show, but we can actually show hidden partitions, if you like, of mass energy within the charged topologies. So with the fermionic matter illustration there, we have all the subatomic particles as per the standard model, but we've also got tetrions, obviously, that aren't included in the standard model because mathematically they're not aware that they exist. They all have charged fascia. The mass energy has a charge as a field geometry. The field geometries of mass energy interact to form charged or uncharged matter topologies. And that's the difference between mass and matter, geometry and topology. When you look really close at the platonic solids and the topology of these subatomic particles in the standard model, you can now start to see the difference between geometry or charge geometry and charge topology. And the difference is these hidden partitions. But these topologies, the displacement topology, is what makes matter matter. It gives it its substance. It gives it weight in a gravitational field. And it gives it a inertial mass, because the equilateral geometry of every Planck quanta is a quantum inductive loop. And that's an electrical equivalent of mass or inertial mass. If you want to accelerate or increase the mass of a particle, you have to add energy to it. These inductive loops will resist having energy added to them. That's inertial mass content of the topology. In the case of mass energy in a chem field, again, still made up of these Planck quanta that are quantum inductive loops. So if you try to increase the energy of a chem field, it will resist adding or subtracting energy from that chem field, and that's inertial mass as expressed in Newton's laws. So now that we have this arrangement of and this understanding of mass energy geometry versus matter topology, and we know that these fields extend out, whether the fields created by thermal energy or by kinetic forces on the particle is irrelevant. Even a static charged particle, when it's in a chem field or an electrostatic field, will be subject to the positive and negative energy momenta of that field, and it will accelerate as it's accelerated by the energy momenta in the field that it's in. It develops its own chem field, which again, dependent on its velocity, will have a differing energy momenta content within it. So the faster it moves, the more energy momenta Planck quanta is found in its chem field, and it will start to interact because of its velocity with other particles around it. Remembering that the chem field is like the wake on a boat. It extends out from the particle, forward from it, and in both directions. And this is why the arrangement of the mass energy and topologies in an electron are such that there is no magnetic moment when it's stopped. But when you start to, when you apply a force to it, the chem field is created, and it creates a secondary. It has kinetic energy, it has linear momentum then, and it also has a magnetic moment that it didn't possess beforehand. And this is where we start explaining relativistic effects in a way that's completely different to relativity theory. Relativity theory would have us believe that that all mass, energy, and matter is contracted due to velocity, and this contraction distorts spherical particles to create a magnetic moment. Tetrionics gives us a charge topology that is invariant to velocity changes, but a chem field of mass energy that changes its energy content in direct relation to the velocity of the particle. And that chem field is where the kinetic energy, the linear momentum, and the magnetic moment are created. They are properties of mass energy, not matter. So by studying just the material body and its motions, we can generate mathematical formulas to describe it, but at no stage would you ever develop a model of how the mass energy at the quantum level creates these mass energy fields and all these properties of what we've discussed, the kinetic energy, the linear momentum, the magnetic moments, the fields of interaction dependent on the charge of the particle, cannot be explained any other way. But they're concisely explained through this tetrionic geometry, even to the stage where, in the case of photons, we can now drop the term massless for photons and clear up a major problem with the mathematics. Photons have energy momenta. They're made up of even number of Planck quanta. Because they're Planck quanta, they have energy. You measure them per second, they are mass energy momenta. It is inappropriate to call a photon field geometry or a photon quanta as massless, because it has energy, therefore it has mass. When you look at the formulations for kinetic energy, etc., and even the relativistic ones, the term massless creates a whole heap of problems. And these are all resolved because we can now define mass, energy, and matter. So we can now re-term photons and EM waves not as massless, but as weightless or matterless. They have no Z component. They're a planar energy form. So therefore, they're mass energy at all times, unless they're destroyed, in which case they cease to be. But they have no Z component. They have no displacement topology. So therefore, they are not particles of matter, and they're not subject to gravitational fields. Again, as we've mentioned time and time again, despite what relativity explains as its interpretation from the mathematics, photons of electromagnetic energy are not bent by gravity near a star. They are refracted by the EM fields of stars in the environment surrounding the star. So again, the immaterial EM fields of stars are what are bending particles close to them and planets, etc. And they play a big role in gravitation. Universal gravitation is a threefold force. Again, once a particle is created, its displacement topology will displace vacuum energies around the particle, and those vacuum energies, under the second law of tetrionics, will seek to push back on that displacement, that positive displacement topology. And by pushing back, they create a convergent, a strictly convergent force on the matter topology. That is a gravity field. Surrounding the matter, we now also have electromagnetic fields, as we've discussed, whether it's thermal or whether it's kinetic. In origin, makes no difference. Every particle of matter, even electrostatic fields, have EM fields around them. And these EM fields create interactive forces, divergent and convergent. So once a particle is created in the universe anywhere, its gravitational field is the result of its topology creating a convergent force, and the interactive forces that the mass energy of the chem fields around them contribute to any particles in their fields. So you can call universal gravitation a threefold force of gravity, of convergent gravity, plus interactive EM forces. But you can only do everything we've just discussed as basic physics. You can only do that through geometry. You can't arrive at this conclusion, the geometric conclusion, through the math, because the math has no inkling of these interactive fields of force. It has no definition for mass versus matter. All that's within the geometry of energy and the topology of matter. So, in to try and summarize, once you understand and can differentiate, define and differentiate mass, energy, matter, and that all the forces of motion are the result of mass, energy, geometries on material particles, you then can model and explain the physics of our universe, and as well as the creation of our universe from Planck quanta of mass, energy, momenta. And it's these geometries and topologies that run the universe. The geometries give us P versus MP, the interaction of particles and their fields with other particles and their fields gives us the Navier-Stokes solutions. They give us all the motion that we perceive as a physical process, and it also explains the immaterial side of the universe that's been hidden to date.
Calvin, you again pulled something wonderful out of the hat. Let me just think back. Essentially, you've just simplified everything by reducing matter to topology, a three-dimensional structure, mm-hmm. and forces to the geometry, which is by definition two-dimensional. Everything that physics describes, which is essentially always three-dimensional because only then can it be measured, is only part of the story. You've carefully explained how and why Descartes was put into a situation that he had to do that at that time. Those times have changed, and now it is a good time to add the other part of the story, which you have now elegantly connected up immediately to everything that we know already. So it means that in extending on the physics that we already know and have described and for which there is mathematics, the only thing that is needed is to see how the three-dimensional material forms are composed out of the two-dimensional Planck units. Mm-hmm. Which is essentially what you describe in tetrionics. It means that tetrionics gives that foundation for physics, which Descartes could not get to because the Vatican claimed monopoly on that.
Yeah.
So, as a result, everything that was known in physics and the mathematics that corresponds with it can now be extended into the force fields of the invisible, which means that the invisible has become very tangible because that's the triangle that the children can play with when they mm-hmm. download the Tetrion template and cut them out and put the forms on the table. You've already said that it is by this understanding of the relationship between the triangles, which are two-dimensional, and the tetrahedra, which are three-dimensional, that we not only have the understanding of how gravity comes into play, because that's the displaced vacuum energy within the three-dimensional structures, but we also see how that what is seen at the level of the triangles is still seen as the surface effect of those three-dimensional forms.
Absolutely.
And of course, that means that a new kind of thinking is required because, as you've already implied, the static and the dynamic flows of electricity and magnetism are a pure consequence of the way these triangles form these three-dimensional shapes. Uh-huh. And coming back to what you've already said, this is something that preschool children can already grasp, which in a way also suggests that for the mathematicians and the physicists who try to get a grasp of tetrionics, their best road into it is to start where those preschool children would start, by seeing how the triangles can create the tetrahedra, how the tetrahedra can create the quanta, the leptons, and the atoms. But that it is not just about seeing how you can then have topological shapes in three dimensions, but that you actually do keep an eye on the arrows on the surface of those three-dimensional forms. And that you see that on the surface there is this ongoing force field, but now as a looped back flow, which means that the three-dimensional forms are actually a kind of perpetuum mobile, because the force flow on the surface of the three-dimensional shapes is actually what keeps them going on. Because it's not just the pink arrow on the triangle which shows where the linear momentum works, but it is also that the rotational momentum on the front and on the back of the triangles interacts with the front side and rear side rotational momentum, the charge of the other triangles in the tetrahedra and in the more complex forms that come out of it. Earlier we have already talked about the relationship between the tetrahedron and the platonic solids. When I asked that question, I didn't realize how simple it is in fact to see that the platonic solids are kept together by the surface flow line, the force flows, these flow forms, which actually keep all of these forms coherent. But it does mean that we need to understand particle physics in terms of the dynamic of the fields of charge when they are folded up from the plane into the three-dimensional forms. Basically, I'm just trying to digest and process and internalize what you've just been explaining, even though what you've said is so very simple. It simply states that you start with the Planck quantum, you play with them as the preschool children would do. As a result, you can see that you can form photons, but also larger triangles composed of these Planck units. And once you realize that these are all immaterial, then you can also see how you can extend that, how you can fold them up, how you can make matter, but that in the matter you still are seeing the effects of those forces. And I would very much like if at some point we can go up into the go on into the details of this, because actually we now have the bridge between the static and the dynamic, between the physics, which is the measurement of the objects and the displacement of the objects, and the mathematics, which tries to describe the relationships between them. But as you have already referred to the P versus NP on the one side and the Navier-Stokes equation on the other, in tetrionics you don't have to address these mathematical descriptions in that manner, for the simple reason that in tetrionics you start with the Planck quantum, which already is an electrical polarity plus a magnetic polarity plus the inversion of it. That means that this is a singularity. So that within the singularity you combine two polarities which are at the same time flat, because that's the triangular shape, but it is also implicitly three-dimensional because it has a charge on the one side and on the other side of the triangle, and that this is essential to keep that in mind when we play with the triangles and use the sticky tape to put them together. It's not the sticky tape that will hold them together, but it is the flow lines of those charges of the polarities in the singularities.
It's the curl. Yeah, curl.
And I'd really like to go into that part of the story at some point, because I know that there are many people, myself included, who learn to look at it from the perspective of the flow and the curl and the rotations and the spirals. But that we can only see now as the force fields being folded up in the material shapes, and as a result that these flow dynamics and curl potentials come into play. So for now, I'd really like to thank you again for hearing you talk about what you have found, because in fact the only thing you have described now is what happens when you take three Planck quanta and you stick them together, but it's only by the story that you can see that it is not about the sticky tape and is not about the resulting tetrahedron which comes out of that, but that we are in fact looking at the difference of something that happens only in time, not in space at all. The force fields exist in time only, but it's only when they start to loop around upon themselves that space is created. So we are dealing here with the actual logical transition from time to space, and for many people that actually calls for a different way of thinking. I will have to digest it myself as well, even though I already had a lot of framework in my mind to explain why that is, as you just described it. But now when I see the simple detail of the way you can address this in tetrionics, again, chapeau, monsieur, because this is really wonderful how you pulled it all together. As usual, I'd like to ask you to round off this recording in any way of your choosing.
What we've done here is something that I often, because I developed a theory, just seems so intuitive that I often forget that people don't see it the same way that I do. After 5 years of playing around with it, I just tend to assume some things. The differentiation between mass and matter is a key part of understanding tetrionic theory. All the properties that we have that we've got in physics, in our formulas of inertial mass and force, what matter is, what fields of interaction are all explained geometrically through rearrangements of these equilateral Planck quanta. And as you say, whether you're using sticky tape or whether you realize that the tape is just holding paper in the arrangements that would be normally done with magnetic or electric fields, charge, makes no difference. But once you get this basic understanding of geometry or mass energy geometries versus matter topologies, you can start in your mind to develop a very simple, simplistic model of physics. And at the same time, even though you just had these pictures of little tetrahedra rushing along with their chem fields and interacting at a distance via these chem fields, you can use that model to quickly do physics in your head and then freeze it and zoom in on a particular detail, if you like. You can look closely at what the arrangement of the Planck quanta in the fields should be to create a certain force or a certain interaction. You can see what temperature looks like as an electromagnetic field, what effect it has on motion. So then you can develop models for chemistry interactions, for bonds, for Brownian motion, and for more complex motions, relativistic motions. You can do all that from a very simplistic understanding of topologies of matter, chem fields or equilateral energy, mass energies, geometries. And if you get that differentiation settled and organized in your head, it becomes a very simple process to model physics. You strip away all the complexity of the math notation and you replace all of that with a visual color-coded geometry. And the real power of that geometry, as we've touched on, is the fact that it can only come together certain ways through the charge, through the electric and the magnetic fields. That rigid geometry and interaction, EM field interaction, dictates what math, what mathematical operations can be conducted in physics. We've now got a situation where the mathematics being developed from the pattern that we couldn't see, all these triangles, is now, while it had been successful, is now developing into multiple theories with many, many assumptions piling on top of each other to create some very absurd and bizarre things. We can now resolve it all back using the geometry and say, here's the grammar that the mathematics is missing. This is what can and cannot be done, because you can only connect these triangles in certain ways. The geometry creates certain physical forces and interactions, and the topologies have, again, their own unique physical properties as a result of their topologies. And they all combine to give us our physics. And that's the basis of this hidden pattern. What's been hidden from physics from the time of the Greeks, because they're Platonic solids. So you can say even Greek physics has worked its way in and been unified along with Newtonian quantum theory and relativity theory. And no doubt you'll see portions of string theory emerge. If you look at the dipole fields in certain ways, you can view them as a string, when in fact it's viewing two triangles from a different angle. All these disparate mathematical physics theories can now be merged back into one coherent geometric formulation where the geometry sets the ground rules, gives us the grammar, and allows us to make some, to have a more advanced understanding of what's really going on, and more importantly, a more intuitive understanding and differentiation between mass, energy, matter, and the forces of motion.
Well, it's wonderful to round it off like that, because as you've shown, you can do this on the table and then you can do it in your mind. And now you've shown how basic that is, because what people could not address before, what is always being considered as enigmatic, untouchable, imaginary, suddenly becomes very real and something you can directly play with. So I'll round off the recording here and thank you again, Kelvin.
Not a problem. Thank you, Wada.